This is the Social Impact Comms Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. My name is Catherine.
And my name is Marie.
Listen in as we share our lessons learned communicating for impact across movements, organizations, and people working for change.
Welcome, everyone, to today's episode. Today, we're really excited to talk about messaging and the importance of crafting strong and impactful messaging.
When you're trying to change the world, or even just your little corner of it, you need to have a strong and persuasive message to win people over and build momentum for change. To have a strong message in social change work, there's a certain type of step and process, and there's certain elements that you need to do to help make a strong message. And we're going to be talking about that today. Talking about what we've learned in messaging and sharing the particular resources and works of experts that we have learned from along the way. So whether you're working in, say, the environmental space, you're working on a social issue, no matter what issue you're working on, no matter what issue is close to your heart, tune in to learn more about messaging and using these tips to build a strong message and build momentum for your cause.
Building momentum for your cause, as Catherine mentioned, does start with strong messaging. When you organize your messaging, you want to make sure that you know who your audience is and who you're talking to so that you know how to make impact within your field. Now, Catherine is always working on creating impactful and strong messaging for different nonprofits and social impact organizations. Catherine, what are your top tips for strong messaging?
Thanks so much for that, Marie. Firstly, I'm going to start off by sharing some top tips. Then we're going to go into a messaging framework, and then we're going to talk about how to have a message guide for your cause. But to answer that, what are some message tips? These are going to be some things Marie's heard me say before, eh? But firstly, you need to have a clear and concise message. It should be short. It should be very clear and easy to understand. And it should be something that people can remember when they hear it, right? You're designing messaging to be repeated around the supper table. We're not writing in dense policy language. It's something that's like a slogan, a catchphrase that people can say on and on and on. Ask yourself, you know, will my aunt, will my brother, will my cousin, will my friend I see every couple of months remember this and pass this message on? A clear message should be the first place that you start, really like a rallying cry. So that's thing number one.
Yeah. So a memorable message that folks can associate with your organization is very important. So like Catherine said, something that's concise and catchy. So Catherine, what would be your second tip?
Secondly, I would say that message repetition is incredibly important. We know from studies of audiences that one of the most important thing to persuade people is for your message to be repeated. So you want to set up a message and set up how you write your messaging and how you write your entire communication strategy. Everything should be reverse engineering, how you can have your message repeated over and over and over and over, truly like a drumbeat, just building a message that's louder and louder and louder as a campaign for your cause. You know, sometimes people will say, oh, like, I feel like I'm starting to repeat myself. And it's like, yeah, you do.
Yes. People need to hear something over and over again.
People need to hear something over and over again. And there's ways to do it, you know, creatively so that, of course, there's just a little bit of variation. Sometimes the message is on the graphic. Sometimes it's in the caption. Sometimes it's in a video. Sometimes it's maybe the second sentence in a post and not the first. There's ways to breathe some life into your content, but there needs to be a fundamental consistency. It's so important. I would say that almost at the point that your staff start getting sick of repeating the message so much, that's almost a good sign. And just go and tell them, like, that's a sign you are executing message discipline with the level of repetition that is needed. If you are not like starting to feel that you're repeating yourself, then it's just not going to be breaking through to your audience. Think about how in the digital age with algorithms, how your audience is only seeing a certain fraction of your content and so much of your audience isn't really seeing it. People are not opening every single email or scrolling throughout your feed, reading every single post in a row, right? Information is coming in a way that is a little here and there and everywhere. So to really build momentum in the public consciousness requires a level of repetition. In political campaigns, whether it's on the electoral side or on the advocacy side, this is a real example of when you can either have one message that's your central core message of a campaign being built louder and louder, like a drumbeat, really spreading with lots of people sharing it, or you can try to get a whole bunch of different messages through. But that second approach doesn't really work so well. If you're trying to be known on an issue and trying to get seven different messages across, it often comes across as unfocused and doesn't really give your audience the same level of understanding of who you are and what you do. So whenever you're planning a campaign, making a really clear central message and repeating it as much as possible and really structuring your campaign for message repetition is important. When a campaign is able to repeat the messaging, eventually it starts to radiate out to the people paying most attention to the campaign, the core supporters. And then all of a sudden, the core supporters start repeating that message to the people around them. And then at the supper table or canvassing at the doorstop or in the workplace, talking to their friends, talking to their families, then those people all of a sudden start hearing the messaging a lot, right? And then they would start to repeat it when they're won over. So that's the level of consistency that it needs to radiate through entire communities, through digital and physical spaces. It's that level of repetition that is needed. So as communication staff or as leaders in social impact organizations, one thing you need to do is make sure that a message is clear and is repeated and keep your finger on the pulse of whether things are ever starting to get a little bit murky and the picture starting to be lost a little bit. So that's the second answer here, Marie, on message repetition.
Really good point, Catherine. So as we talked about, the first tip is to have clear and concise messaging. And the second tip is to focus on repetition. Repetition is key. You want that clear and concise messaging to be remembered and to be on top of people's minds when they're thinking about your organization. So Catherine, what would be your third tip?
The third tip I would share is using an emotional hook to ground your messaging, and more specifically, grounding your messaging in shared values. So shared values are universal shared values that echo across all of humanity, not just your friends, not just your coworkers, but all of humanity, including people who maybe don't agree with you on the issue. So it's looking across more than just your bubble and thinking about what brings us together. So some universal shared values are: everyone wants to feel safe. Everyone wants to feel respected. Everyone wants love from their family and loved ones. Everyone wants to feel like they have a safe and stable place to call home. Those are just some examples. All youth deserving to be respected and able to focus on learning and growing at school, right? Those are some examples of shared values. So a communications expert who focuses on communications research named Anat Shankar-Zorio has done an extensive amount of research on how communications can persuade audiences on different social impact and particularly social justice and social issue causes. A lot of the different materials that you'll be hearing us share today certainly are heavily influenced by Anat, and you'll find further reading from Anat's work in the show notes. So one thing that has come out of her body of work is measuring and articulating how leading with universal shared values is the most effective way to persuade audiences on issues that may be divisive, hot button social issues that we need to win and campaign over. We're talking abortion. We're talking issues of race and class and immigration. We're talking sex ed, issues related to queer and trans youth, that type of thing, right? And some of Anat's work has looked into how to communicate across divides and persuade people. You know, something that we've talked about before, Marie, is how to communicate about these issues, but make sure that we're not only communicating in our bubble.
Yeah, because it's very common to be able to speak to the same people who already believe what you believe, who already stand for what you stand for. When we're talking about getting your message out there, your message is clear and concise. It's repetitive, but you also want it to draw that emotional connection because that's how people spread your message. They feel connected to it. They share it with other people who feel connected with it. So that bubble is able to grow and include even bigger conversations that can help your organization make an impact.
because it's that emotional hook that has been proven to be the most effective at persuading people. Yeah. That is in contrast to, say, for example, leading with a whole bunch of statistics or a whole bunch of dense policy language or yelling at someone, you know what I mean? Because again, sometimes it's an argument. Things can get heated, but it's that type of shared values language that leaves the best chance at persuading people. So to give a bit of an example, something that we'll talk about through different episodes of this podcast season is the spike in hate against queer and trans people and queer and trans youth in Canada and how provincial conservative premiers rolled back human rights, which is unfortunate, but that was the situation we found ourselves with. But there's a communications and campaigning and narrative lens to analyze here. Sometimes the initial campaigning response was to knee-jerk tell the opposition why they were wrong.
Or to present data as a reason why some of these beliefs weren't true.
Yeah, also sometimes we saw a lot of people trying to take the opposition's frame of so-called parental rights and say, oh, parental rights isn't about hate, it's actually about love, and here's why we're right. But there were all of these different ways that didn't necessarily center with shared values and emotion. And unfortunately, that doesn't help build the groundswell of momentum for your campaign that a shared values approach does, right? So that was an example of why we're helping organizations, helping the movement and campaigns build a more shared values approach to the messaging. We'll leave a note to a campaign message guide on supporting trans youth in the show notes to help you see a bit of an example of this in action. But to take some examples from that case, it was the type of messaging that's a shared values approach there was to say things like, all kids deserve to feel safe and respected when they go to school so they can learn and grow and thrive as their true and authentic selves. That's an example of an opening line in messaging that has that shared values approach, right? Like thinking about what feelings unite us as people. And we can all think about being kids. Some people also have kids that they're watching growing up. Thinking about how being safe and respected and thriving as our true and authentic selves is a good thing. Mm-hmm. Whether you are trans, whether you are not, whether you are, you know, a part of the 2SLGBTQ+ community or not, no matter where you live, no matter what your background is, those are some like human emotions that we can all relate to, right? And that's why it's picking at those emotions. So that's a bit of an example of a shared values approach. Again, we're leaving these materials in the show notes from Anat's work and how we collaborated with other organizations on that message guide to help bring that approach more deeply to Canada on that issue in a moment of crisis. Just to give some credit where credit was due, that message guide was worked on by our company, LeBlanc Co. Communications, also Momentum, also EGAL Canada, and the Canadian Center for Gender and Sexual Diversity.
Really great points on that emotional connection, really focusing on those human-centered values that bring people together. Shared values are the way to really get people in their emotional feels when it comes to messaging. So just to recap, we focused on tip number one being having some clarity and consistency when it comes to your messaging. Repetition across all your messaging. Like you said, Catherine, if you feel tired of saying your messaging, that is probably a really good sign.
Keep going.
Keep going. Exactly. And then we also focus on the feels, focusing on those shared values, that emotional connection that really brings people together, like love, safety, and acceptance. So Catherine, are there any other tips you could throw our way?
To add one last communications and messaging tip here before moving into some practical frameworks and advice, I'd say that you need to build your own narrative and frame and stick with it and just make it clearer and clearer, louder and louder, more and more repeated. And to not worry about getting bogged down in your opposition's frame, because quite often it's a trap. So what do we mean by that? An opposition in this case is, say, if you're communicating on a human rights issue, it's like, who are the hate groups campaigning against you? But also just like everyday people weighing in with hate online and in their everyday lives, right? So that's what we mean by opposition in this case. And an opposition frame on a human rights issue could be,
whatever
offensive hot take they have been trying to advance lately, right? You know, mm-hmm. what, like, whatever is the trendy, hateful thing to say. So the thing is about, you know, the hateful opposition group. They're trying to be catchy. They're trying to be in the news. They're trying to persuade people. They're going to say different things and test different things. And whenever they're finding something that is unfortunately catching on, that's what they're going to run with.
Yeah.
And that's what they're going to say thousands or millions of different times, right? So to give the example we're talking about before with the spike in hate against 2SLGBTQ plus youth and the provincial conservative premiers rolling back the rights in school, we saw a opposition narrative of so-called parental rights emerging. You know, they just test different things. They see what works. They see what builds some momentum and then run with it, right? So to build your own frame in this case means, for example, not going on the radio. What we know through communications and audience research is when you repeat the bad thing to argue against it, unfortunately, you're undermining yourself and your work, like whether it's on human rights or something else. Because unfortunately, when you're repeating the bad thing just to argue against it, unfortunately, you're cementing the bad thing even further in people's minds. So I'm just going to give you an example of something that is kind of dramatic language to give an example. So, you know, obviously to be talking about human rights messaging, sometimes we need to give an example of something that's a little bit offensive. So say if, regrettably, someone, a far right figure, were to be going on the radio using the term groomer to be referring to queer and trans people, for example. Obviously, that is not the case, and that is a bad thing to say, but just giving that as an example of some far right messaging. If you were to go on the radio and to argue about why that was wrong, you should never, ever, ever repeat the bad word or repeat the word groomer, because unfortunately, even if someone were to hear just your radio clip, not even the bad guy's radio clip, but just your radio clip, if they heard, for example, the word queer, then the word groomer, they're not necessarily going to remember like, oh, that's wrong, or like, that's not true. Like, just the most dramatic words in that type of clip are more what surfaces in people's memory. Think about how often when you're watching TV, you're also eating, you're cooking, you're cleaning. When you're in the car, you know, you're commuting, someone's driving their kids to school. Like, some words are remembered more deeply than others. And we know through audience testing that if you're making the progressive take on an issue, if you repeat the bad words, unfortunately, you're scoring on your own net. And even if you don't realize, even if it is, you know, completely by accident, which I mean, of course it always is, you are cementing the hateful or opposition language more. And it's the same for politicians. And when people get very media trained, it's why you're not easily able to elbow someone who's very media trained into, you know, admitting or saying something, right? And sometimes it's because if you got that clip of the prime minister admitting to something he shouldn't be admitting to, that clip would be on blast and on blast on blast. We don't want human rights advocates to be caught into traps and saying things that are going to be used as almost propaganda. So to summarize this point, when you are campaigning, you are building your own message for change, making it concise, clear, effective, setting it up to be repeated over and over and over. You're grounding in emotion, but then you're staying in your lane. You're making your own highway and you're driving down it. You're inviting everyone to drive down that amazing highway for change.
Yeah.
And you're not like pulling out a map to look out where the bad guys are and trying to chase after their truck, right? Because when we try to play in an opposition's frame, we typically lose. Like, we're not going to outmaneuver opposition messaging by repeating it or trying to like play with their logic, right? Because opposition messaging is not specifically being made with good faith. And we know from what tests with audiences that it doesn't actually persuade people. So this is why you create your message and you repeat it and you repeat it and you repeat it and repeat it. And of course, when something bad happens, sometimes you're still going to be doing media or putting something out, right? But it's like, what is centered, right? Mm-hmm. If your local MP says something terrible and, you know, your organization is responding to that in the media, are you centering your messaging, or is every second line out of your mouth just saying like, oh yeah, and then he said this and here's why he's wrong, and he said this where he's wrong? there are some times when you can jump in and comment on something that's happened, but center your own messaging as much as possible and just generally be aware of framing and build your own frame and be really worried about jumping into the opposition frame. Framing, by the way, is how language sets up the parameters for your audience to understand an issue.
I really like that point, Catherine, because messaging is even more powerful when it's repeated, when it's concise, when it has that emotional connection. Whenever you get the opportunity to share your messaging, use that opportunity to share that and do not fall into the trap of repeating the oppositional messaging. It can feel really tempting to, especially if it's something that you know is completely in left field, is completely factually incorrect, but really take the opportunity to repeat your messaging.
Yeah. What you said that was interesting there, you said if it's tempting, and it honestly can be tempting. Honestly, the knee-jerk reaction is often to pop into the news and just critique what someone is doing wrong, but just being aware of the frame that's being built. Are you building up their frame or your own frame and just being mindful of that?
Exactly. And, you know, Catherine, you gave that example of like, if you're on a radio show, you don't want to repeat a word that's been used in a negative connotation. You know, like you said, we're often multitasking in this everyday life. So if someone's going to hear about that topic for the first time ever, you don't want them to hear you use something that you know is oppositional.
Absolutely. That's such a good point, right? You know, people can get a positive, effective introduction to an issue, right? And it's your chance and opportunity to do that.
Exactly. Catherine, thank you so much for those tips. I know that that is a lot of information to take in. And if it's your first time hearing it, it might feel a little bit overwhelming. So Catherine, how about we move on to some more practical framework, hands-on type approach to messaging?
Yeah, Marie, you're certainly right. There's a lot to know about messaging, but it's something that you can learn over time, practice, you know, improve where you can and come back to resources,
Exactly. Right?
This is not an all one and done in one day thing to take on. So what Marie asked was different practical frameworks for messaging, and I'm going to share three. So one is going to be talking about a 4-bullet framework. Secondly, I'm going to more explicitly talk about the race, class, gender narrative. And then thirdly, we're going to talk about our favorite storytelling framework by Marshall Gans. So we're going to break this down, jump in with any questions at any time, Marie, and let's make this as practical as possible for listeners. So firstly, there's a way that we like to teach messaging at LeBlanco Communications. It's what we put into templates that we give to clients, is what we teach in workshops. And it's just like the most accessible but effective way we found. What's the easiest, most accessible way to start with how to structure your messaging? Because I can't just show up with, here is my 20-page research report that I found that I really like reading myself. Here you go, little nonprofit. That's so overwhelming, right?
Mm-hmm.
For anybody, truly, truly, truly for anyone. So what we do is we like to lead with a framework that's quite inspired by a lot of the different experts that you'll see cited and referenced in our show notes. And it boils down a lot of their approaches. And here is what we mean by the 4-bullet framework. So open up your Google Documents or your Word doc, and you'd be typing in bullets. But also note that there's going to be an example in the show notes. We'll make a little template there for you. So if you need to write messaging on an issue, we encourage people to write it in bullets, not paragraphs, because then you get rambly. Bullets, really, writing bullets goes a long way.
Yeah, and it's super accessible. If you're feeling like you need the messaging on the go, writing in bullets is the best way to do it.
Yeah, and you write messaging first before you jump to a press release, before you jump to website copy and newsletter. Like, you're starting messaging, you know, just in general before breaking it down to a product.
Mm-hmm.
So the 4 bullets is bullet number one. It's going to be an emotional connection, and try to make it an emotional connection grounded in shared values, like we were talking about before, right? So that's the first bullet. It's first because it literally needs to come first. That's what breaks the ice.
Yeah, that's the hook.
That's the hook. Yeah. Exactly, Marie. That's what gets people to care. So it needs to come first. It needs to be centered and really made a priority in the messaging. This is, instead of putting a statistic first or like yelling at someone, it's that first bullet grounded in, you know, a shared universal value to make that emotional hook. Sometimes a story is also a good emotional hook, but opening with that first bullet. And then to move on to the second bullet in the four bullet framework, the second bullet is naming the problem. And you're going to make it as clear as possible. I like to think of high school English class where you can either obscure what's happening and use the passive voice, or you can be very specific and name the active voice. So you're calling out the problem, and you also should call out who caused it, right? Who's the villain of the story?
And who is it affecting?
Who is it affecting? Who did it? Make it, you know, as clear as possible. Name the problem. You've already hooked people emotionally, and now you got to call out who caused this issue. You're not going to say like, oh, communities were impacted by, you know, something in some sort of just like mysterious way. Like, call out the entity that caused the problem, you know, and say what they did and who it's impacting, and make it as clear as possible. That's bullet number two. Now, bullet number three is naming the solution, right? Mm-hmm. So what would solve this? What is your organization or your campaign doing and or proposing to fix this? You know, get clear, say what you're doing, and you're also articulating your vision for the future. Mm-hmm. Make it specific and make it enticing. Like, don't make it in policy gobbledygook, really unclear, like, oh, we got to pass bill number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, right? People can't visualize that. You're naming the solution, what you're doing and proposing, and what's the actual clear vision for the future. Make it clear. And also, like, think about if you can make it a little bit emotional, right? Mm-hmm. Like, does everyone now have housing? You know, how are you making it specific? What's the rights? What's the resources? Like, how are you making an impact in everyone's life, right? Yeah. You're saying the solution, but make it as tangible as possible. Don't make it as technical and removed from people's everyday life, saying like, oh, we need to pass the amendment on this bill, because then that's nice.
Yeah.
It's like, make people care. Think back to all the reasons why we said an emotional hook is specific. And also, you're thinking about the big picture, but also talking about what your organization is doing. And then after you've done the emotional hook, after you've done the problem and then the solution, you're going to close with a call to action. And a call to action is very important, because we're working with organizations and campaigns of varying sizes, and you want to make it specific and clear and easy for people to understand how to help you. So a call to action would be why people need to donate to your cause to fuel this work. Or a call to action is why someone needs to sign a signature for your organization or for the House of Commons, or take any other kind of action. Showing up to an event, a protest, a webinar, joining something, you know, and obviously you're going to want to try and come up with a good call to action. Mm-hmm. But the thing is this framework needs to work for different organizations with big capacity, low capacity, and so many different issues and contexts. So for now, we'll just leave you with like, come up with a call to action. And know that, of course, you can have like different calls to action depending on the time. One day you may be organizing a protest, and then another day you may not, and you may be fundraising, right?
Exactly.
And building, however, the repetition of that messaging as much as possible. So that's the framework. You know, you'll see a lot of further reading in the show notes on, you know, different types of messaging resources that have inspired this, but this is how we teach it to clients. That's like our easiest possible, most accessible way, because messaging is hard. It's so hard. No one just has 5 hours to take out of their day as a busy nonprofit executive director just to write messaging. So it's easy to have such a simple framework. So we encourage people to start with that four bullet framework, emotional hook, problem, solution, call to action. Writing your messaging like that, start doing that first, teach that to your team first, right? Move away from long rambly paragraphs, move away from starting writing web copy, like start with the messaging first. And then when you can, like come back to the rest of this podcast of advice and all of our reading and apply all of that too. But if you need somewhere to start, I would say start there. But we have a couple more frameworks and tips to share with you today as well.
Absolutely. And Catherine, I personally love that framework because I find that it's really, really grounded in human psychology and the way people understand things.
Yes.
And the way people's opinions are swayed or their thoughts are challenged about something that they might have believed to be one way. And I really like the part about naming the problem, naming the opposition, naming who they're affecting, but then introducing the solution and then incorporating your organization within that solution and the work that you're doing or your campaign within that solution. And then a call to action, which also brings the individual into thinking, what can I do to support, okay, X organization is doing this work. Now, what can I do as an individual? And that really comes through with the call to action.
Yes, it's something that can work for organizations, but also for movements.
Exactly.
And you're just really wanting that messaging to be repeated as much as possible. It's not owned by any one organization. You're wanting reproductive healthcare organizations or climate organizations all working on the same issues to be echoing the messaging and having a lot of similarity in the messaging, even when they're working on a slightly different call to action.
Yeah.
That's the first practical framework that we would share.
Yes.
And now we have a couple more things to talk about, Marie, and want to highlight some of the resources being linked into the show notes. We're going to talk about the race, class, gender narrative next. Now, so we keep on talking about this great set of research, and we just want to talk about it in a little bit more detail now. There's something called the race, class, gender narrative. It started as the race, class narrative, but now work is being deepened to have a deeper gender focus, thinking about all of the attacks on gender marginalized people, the attacks on women, reproductive health care, choice, and also incredibly important, all of the attacks on queer and trans youth and queer and trans people, the lens there being broadened to the gender side. So let's chat a little bit about where this came from and who worked on it and how you can learn more about this in the show notes. So in the last half decade, there's been a body of work on how to communicate to people on progressive social issues to win them over, right? So if that's issues like immigration, being able to talk about immigration in a way that is accepting and welcoming and not from a place of xenophobia, whether that's abortion and reproductive healthcare choices, whether that is affirming and supporting to us LGBTQ plus youth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the types of issues that we're talking about. And the race, class, gender narrative was built to help communicate to the public on these issues, including when you're communicating to someone who their own lived experience may not line up to the issue. You need to be communicating to a lot of different groups at once, right? You need to communicate to white people living in the suburbs about race. You need to communicate to people across different classes. You need to communicate to people who are of newcomer experience, but also people who have grown up in your country. You have to communicate across so many different contexts about issues. So you have a lot of issues to win people over on, but also people are coming from so many different contexts. So the race, class, gender narrative studies, it's like how to win over white people talking about race and racism and immigration, how to win over men on abortion, how to win over people who may align with the lived experience of an issue, but also who may not. And just quite frankly, it's how to reach across and communicate across divides.
Yeah. And it's really something that focuses on communicating with a range of people, with a range of beliefs. And if you want your messaging to make an impact, that's what you need to do, is to reach a range of people and to connect with them in different ways.
It makes me think about American politics, given that this framework came out of the United States.
Yeah.
And it makes me think about 10 years ago, communications being even more segregated than they are now on talking about class or talking about race.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean every single politician and in every single context, but there's always that stereotype of white politicians needing to do a better job to integrate those issues. Think of different criticisms of Bernie in 2016, just to give a bit of an example, right? There has, of course, been progress in bringing these issues together, but it's important to have frameworks that help teach us how to communicate across different groups and contexts on different groups and issues that may relate to you and may not, but how to draw out that human context, right? Making people think about the shared human experience, whether you may not be a newcomer, whether you may not be trans, digging into the same human shared experiences of wanting respect and flourishing as your own true authentic self. So a number of different organizations and communications experts came together to develop this framework. Again, first the race class narrative, and then later the race class gender narrative that my understanding is still being developed even more. And what's great about this is that this framework was tested. It is empirical. It has been done through focus grouping of audiences to actually know, okay, if we come to people with this message, message A, which is made in a certain way, and then if we come to them with message B, what is more persuasive? Marie and I work with a lot of groups And not everyone has access to a polling budget. Not everyone has access to a focus group's budget, either the time, the money to do this, right? We're all working with our own anecdotal evidence in our campaigning on what's resonating, what's not. And we certainly do work with some organizations that have the type of budget, but it's not every single day social impact organizations in your corner of the world can go and drop $25,000 on market research, right? So we need to make it democratic and make it accessible to pull from the messaging and campaigning research that is there, share the information around for people to learn from this. So this is like a approach that grew out of the United States. Fun fact, there's also a race, class, gender narrative in the UK. I've heard a little bit about this. I heard something about a version being brought to the UK because every country has their own context. I mean, that's a whole can of worms, right? Thinking about different things going on in the UK, right? And different specific contexts. And it also makes me think about the trans youth message guide work brought to Canada to bring some of this framing context a little bit more accessible. So I feel like Marie and I could talk about the lessons in the race, class, gender narrative all day because it's so deep. There's a lot of context. We've woven pieces in this in our podcast today, but we'd also just encourage you to read it, to check out the show notes, to follow the work there even more, to give another shout out to some things in the show notes. There's something called the We Make the Future group, which is the implementation home, the nonprofit that's putting out different message guides on climate and social issues using the race, class, gender narrative. And then there's also the consulting firm of Anat Shankar-Sorio, the researcher we were talking about. So a lot of good stuff there. Please listen to it. But to round off this point on the race, class, gender narrative, a finding coming out of that is, let's give the example of communicating on immigration. Let's think about if you're in American politics and you're communicating about the border. Let's think about if you're communicating, could be in Canada, the US, or anywhere else, and you're campaigning for some reason on immigration. The research shows that if you don't talk about race when you're campaigning on the progressive side, the issue is that your opposition, the right wing, the far right, they'll talk about race and they'll say bad stuff.
Yeah.
So then if the progressives don't acknowledge race, then that means that the dog whistle of the far right just goes unchecked and there's nothing there to neutralize that. Mm-hmm. Right? So no matter our background, whether we grew up as an immigrant or whether we grew up here in Winnipeg, that's the type of messaging. No matter our background, whether we are white, whether we are black, whether we are indigenous, whether we are racialized or any type of background, we all know that it's important to love and respect our loved ones and everyone else around us. That's the type of messaging that's been shown to help neutralize the bad stuff. So that's just a bit of an example that sometimes it's thought, oh, like, let's water down our messaging a little bit. Well, don't leave your net without a goalie.
That makes me think, Catherine, that a lot of oppositional messaging is divisive or can be divisive. There can be that fear of, if I talk about race, I might be divisive too. But that example you gave of, regardless of your background, that's a way to talk about race without giving that divisive messaging of this or that.
Exactly. You're not hearing someone say something offensive and then coming up with a clipboard being like, well, this guy said that, and then my refutation of that is this. You're not doing what we said before on accidentally amplifying the opposition background by playing in their frame, by driving down their highway. You're building your own highway and you're piggybacking off of the messaging research that exists to do so in a more persuasive way.
Absolutely. And there's such rich messaging research. And I feel we're so lucky to have the race, class, gender narrative as a way to understand what moves people and what helps make a really big impact when it comes to social impact work.
We're big fans.
Yeah, huge fans. And we feel that we're so lucky to have that type of framework when it comes to building strong and impactful messaging. So that is all good. That framework is really helpful. But if you think about the fact that some organizations are in a position where they're still like, okay, where do we go from here? What can we create that will actually help our organization get this organized? Catherine, what direction would you point them to?
I know. Where do I start, right?
Yeah.
If you're a communications coordinator, communications manager, you could be an executive director, you could be in an advocacy role. They gave us a lot of frameworks. Like,
what now?
Yeah, what now? So we encourage organizations, whether you are a social impact organization or a campaigning group, to have a message guide.
Yeah.
So a message guide is where you develop and write down your messaging, and then you polish it and you keep it in one place. And it's this guide that you make everyone refer to a lot, right? It's the place, the source of truth of your messaging. Because otherwise it's, oh, dang, what did we say about this thing? Can someone pull that tweet from 3 years ago?
Exactly.
Or like, ooh, Marie said a smart thing a month ago. What was it? Or, didn't we come up with a better way to say that?
Yeah.
It's too confusing, right? So it's just like how your organization would have bylaws to refer back to. It's that type of document of truth. So you may not read your bylaws every day.
Yeah.
You're looking at your strategic plan quite often, pulling out your message guide quite often too. We like to put a message guide and a comms plan as two separate documents typically, because if your messaging is on page 17 of your comms plan, no one will read it. Like, trust us, we have tried. Yeah. We know.
The comms person will read it.
Hopefully. But then sometimes forget too, right? So, it's just putting it in a separate document for your messaging goes a long way. And then it's a tighter, shorter document. So what would be in a message guide? A message guide would articulate those formal, almost organizational strat plan type things like mission, vision, values, mm-hmm. those types of guiding things that you as the comms employee maybe didn't get to write. Maybe someone did a while ago, but those should be there because it helps remind you to keep them up to date.
Yeah.
Are they in alignment or out of alignment? Because if your messaging is pulling in one direction and your mission statement is pulling up in another direction, it doesn't work very well because mission statement's probably somewhere very prominent on your website and it's causing some confusion. So start off with some of that formal messaging and ideally have a mission statement that's actually helpful mm-hmm. for your comms and pulling in the same direction. Then you're going to have organizational level messaging, an elevator pitch, a four bullet elevator pitch for your organization or your cause. And also I like to do one liner, be it a slogan, something like that, a brand positioning statement to explain what you do in one sentence.
Yeah.
I don't want you to have 15 different ways to intro your organization. Just have a really tight one line and then a really tight four bullet elevator pitch, quite frankly. So those are some things to do. And that's why that four bullet framework, it works to campaign, but it also could work for a nonprofit or a social enterprise or something to be pitching anything really.
It's
that human psychology of the hook, the problem, the solution, and what to do next. After that, I'd like to put the tone guidance, the tone brand voice. You also could put that at the top. There's ways to structure this in the way that best suits your organization. So for tone and brand voice, think, what are the attributes to describe your organization's voice? What adjectives? Is it approachable and is it friendly?
Mm-hmm.
Or are you authoritative and an expert? Describe, almost if you were doing a visual branding exercise and asking what you were looking for and try to articulate it. Now, we've written this out in different ways, but we've recently liked putting it in a table. If the adjective is bright, then define what that means and then maybe give a usage example.
Yeah.
Right. So take the time to map out your organization's brand, voice, and tone. Now, moving along in your message guide, some other things that you're going to want to do. You could probably have key messaging for your really important anchoring work, like your programs.
Exactly.
Or maybe for an advocacy organization, your key pillars of advocacy. So the things that you're talking about the most, writing down. You also may want to write down if your organization has anything contentious that mm-hmm. you think you're going to have to be talking about a lot in the same document or perhaps in a separate one for leadership, sort of depends on the context, right? And lastly, you're probably going to be ending things off with some word choice stuff that is important and meaningful and carries weight. There's always equity and power dynamic intersections with word choice, right? So writing it down to help institutionalize the memory of you capitalize the I in Indigenous, you capitalize the B in Black. What your organization does is going to depend on what the word choice is. Like, mm-hmm. do we describe ourselves in one way or another way? If you're a service delivery organization, another one would be, how do you describe the people who access your services, right?
Yeah.
And just troubleshoot thinking of mistakes that could be made and then how to fix it. And some people will also put like a grammatical, some key style guide type things in the message guide as well. Sometimes that's written separately, but just make sure to have it somewhere. So there you go.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's our message guide drive-by. we work with groups on that all the time. So hit us up if you want a little bit more help.
Absolutely. And one thing I love to add when it comes to a message guide is that everyone who is working in your organization should be aware of the existence of this message guide.
Yes.
So who needs to be trained on the message guide? Every single person, even if you're a frontline service organization, folks that are welcoming people into whatever center you're running need to know about the message guide. Folks that are working on the social media need to know about the message guide. So we always say, include it in your onboarding documents. Make sure when you're doing that bit of training, welcoming something to the organization, you're also going through the message guide with them.
Yeah, it needs to be rolled out formally, like all staff meeting type thing. It's that important. Rolled out formally, trained everyone, new people, put it in their onboarding packages, Marie said. And then whenever someone in leadership or in the comms team or anyone really senses that there's misalignment issues on the messaging, you got to do another all staff meeting or memo or something to pull that back together. And then my last rollout tip would be to have one person in charge of editing the document. You don't want 11 different people making edits flying in and out. Everyone can and should give feedback on like, ooh, I came up with a better way to say this. But only one person should be actually editing it or approving it. Just for some consistency and clarity. It is a living document that gets better and better. At a certain point, it should be sort of like finished, but then edited more as needs pop up, which it'll be edited a lot if there's ever a massive shift in vision for the organization. But it's also just common to come up with a better way of saying things.
Exactly.
Need to crack back in.
Yeah. So a message guide, like we said, is definitely an important tool for an organization to have. And it's super helpful when it comes to making sure everyone's on the same page when it comes to your messaging. And that messaging lives somewhere that you can continuously refer to it and continuously update it when it comes to your organization's growth or changes. So there are so many things we could talk about when it comes to messaging, but truly one of my favorite parts of messaging is storytelling and how to tell the story of your organization, of your movement. So storytelling is a big part of messaging, and that's another part of messaging that we both really love to talk about. Catherine, do you want to get into storytelling and messaging a little bit?
Yes. And something that we think about a lot is that sometimes we see how storytelling is talked about in social change and how messaging is talked about in social change. They can sometimes feel almost in isolation from each other or not woven together enough as an approach. So certainly throughout further episodes of this podcast, we're going to go into more detail on this, but we want to, as a little bonus, wrap things out today with our favorite storytelling framework. And if the framework we gave earlier, that four-bullet framework, is more of a organizational approach, now we want to give a framework that can help you tell your personal story or that can help you work with someone else to support them in telling their personal story. So that could be someone who is campaigning on behalf of an organization or someone who has interacted with your cause in some way. This is a personal storytelling framework. So there is a man named Marshall Ganz. He is currently a professor at Harvard, but decades ago, he was a labor organizer helping to support migrant workers in unionizing and obviously accessing better supports and unionizing in the effort of securing higher wages, better working conditions, because we know the issues that are faced by migrant workers. So because of that context in trying to unionize migrant workers, Marshall Ganz needed to help these workers develop a platform in an effective way to harness their quite poignant personal stories and to help direct them towards change, right? How do you bridge the gap between someone's personal story and whatever you're calling for? Stories are effective, but a story alone needs to bridge towards something to be actually linked to the cause, right? So this is a framework that if you're telling your personal story for an issue, or if you're working to help someone tell their personal story for an issue, here's how you can help bridge from the personal to a campaign or to the organizational. So Marshall Ganz has a theory that you start with story of self, you move on to story of us, and then you move on to story of now. So you start with your story of self. The story of self is what you have gone through, what has impacted you, what challenge have you gone through, or what helped make you who you are. Then you move on to the story of us. You bridge from what I personally have gone through, and then you bridge to what my community has gone through, what yeah. other people have gone through, why this is a common occurrence or a structural issue, a systemic issue. Name out, as we said before, the villain, name the person or the structure that is causing this issue. So you're bridging from yourself to a more community or societal issue, mm-hmm. leading with the poignant emotional hook of your own personal story, but then bridging to why it is a collective issue. And then you build the urgency by bridging to the story of now. You have the personal issue, the fact that it affects more people, but then you get to move people with the why now and why act now, and also the, and what do we do now and what comes now? That would be some of the work of Marshall Ganz in helping people to harness their stories. So a little bit of a fun fact about this is we live in Canada. Our podcasts and resources can be certainly listened to by anyone. Shout out to all of our listeners from different places. But to give a particular Canadian example was that Marshall Ganz helped inspire Olivia Chow, the mayor of Toronto, Olivia Chow, after she ran for mayor the first time, lost. She then spent years helping to train people in organizing and personal storytelling frameworks to mm-hmm. help harness their personal story and their community's stories for change. She helped set up the Institute for Change Leaders that is training movements and campaigns and organizations and activists for change on this type of storytelling and organizing framework. And then, if anyone can remember Olivia's last campaign, she used her personal story very effectively because she had been teaching this for years at this point. And you can think about, for those of you who can remember the campaign, she'd talk about how when she decades ago was going to university in Toronto, she could, on a student salary, be able to afford a one bedroom. How that when her mom needed support, her mom could move in with her.
Yeah.
She talked about how her mom could afford rent with her mom being a domestic worker. Thinking about the affordability crisis, but contrasting the before with the now, she talked about her personal story on housing, bridge to the community story on housing, and then bridge to the why now. So that's just an example. And like, I've never even lived in Toronto. I lived in Ottawa, and then I moved in Winnipeg, and I grew up in Nova Scotia. So that's a good example of a story actually breaking through because I can remember it, right? Yeah. And Marshall Ganz also worked with the Obama campaign in 2008, quite famously. So those are some examples of it can help a political candidate harness their story. It can help a executive director or mm-hmm. person who's benefited from a program or a person who's standing behind an issue in a certain campaign. No matter who you are, we all have stories to harness, to bring to the table, but it can sometimes require a little bit of thinking on how do you weave stories into a campaign and how can stories be used strategically? And also, how can we help someone who's being as vulnerable to tell their story? How can we best support them and best link it into the work? So as our last little storytelling bonus, because any chat about messaging always needs to link into story, we were just happy to share that last framework.
Exactly. And, you know, oftentimes with nonprofits and social impact organizations, we kind of struggle to find ways to tell the story of the yes. impact of our work. And this framework is a really good tool to kind of help you center, okay, how do we tell the story without just using that uh-huh. 70% of this and that type yes. of data? This framework is a really good way to position the story of your organization, of the people your organization have impacted. It's a really, really useful tool to do
We like to joke that you can't just say like, come to our webinar. Thanks for coming to our webinar. Come to our next webinar.
Yeah.
Marie is really right on the mm-hmm. impact of storytelling to show the whole purpose of why we're showing up and yeah. showing up here today. So
absolutely. Thank you so much for tuning in today, listening to us talk about messaging, listen to us talk about the importance of strong messaging and what you need to consider when you are writing messaging to make an impact.
Whether you are campaigning, whether you are establishing messaging for an organization, whether you're trying to link a story with a message, we hope that this inspires you with your social change work. Thanks for tuning in.
Bye.